This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. We've got film, poetry, and the Blind Idol Singing Competition finals coming up today, but we begin with dance. This year's UNC School of the Arts Winter Dance commemorates the past while celebrating the new, with legendary choreographers Sir Frederick Ashton and Merce Cunningham, and two world premieres, UNCSA's Trish Casey's Looking Back and Metallurgy by Dean of Dance Susan Jaffe. Susan is joined by former Merce Cunningham Dance Company dancers Meg Harper and Andrea Weber. Together, they bring decades of experience to bear in setting the legendary choreographer's riveting sound dance on the young and gifted UNCSA dancers. Meg Harper joined the Merce Cunningham Dance Company not long after his groundbreaking choreography titled Walk Around in 1968. She recalls working with Merce for the first time and watching him put the piece together.
In terms of underlying ideas, motivations, narratives, they really don't exist for the dancer. Merce may have certain feelings about what he's creating, but his whole method of working was to abandon those kind of classical themes and to throw out narrative, to throw out cause and effect, to change the way one looked at the stage so there was no hierarchy of performers or no most important place on the stage. So when I was watching him create this walk-around time, I began to see how he would construct movement segments and then place them within an hour. And it was just astonishing, even for me, as naive as I was then, I was aware this was really quite remarkable. I started dancing very late in college, actually, at the University of Illinois, and that's where I came across Cunningham and Cage's work and their aesthetic. And I saw that this is exactly what I wanted to do. And I went specifically to New York City to study with Merce because it was this kind of thing that spoke to me. Both Cage and Cunningham have tremendous respect for the audience and that they are an equal participant in this experience. So when you come to look at this work, and this goes for actually any work, it's your experience. You don't have to look for what the artist was intending because it's right in front of you, watching the movement, watching whatever interests you because there's going to be so much on the stage, you can't take it all in at one time. So trust your eye, trust what your eye directs you to. And even though you will miss something, that's the way life is. You won't see everything in a landscape if you stop your car. You see some things, but you miss other things. So just relax and enjoy it.
Andrea Weber joined the Merce Cunningham Dance Company in 2004 and performed roles in dozens of Cunningham's works. She was there for the company's farewell tour in December of 2011. Merce Cunningham passed away in 2009.
He was very active with us in the creative process. He was creating really throughout. So that part of it was always very consistent. We would be in the creation process of a new work. Maybe it slowed down a little bit as he aged, but we were still creating and reconstructing older work, which he didn't participate in at first. We would reconstruct it and he would be working on his new work by himself. And then when we were finished in that reconstruction, he would really turn to us and work on it, rehearse it, play with it. And then there was the existing rep, the repertory that we always had, and he ran those pieces every day, called curtain before and after, and we would go through it and do notes. So it was actually very consistent.
Andrea, I remember when I was at the studio and Merce was creating Nearly 90, which was his very last piece, and I was outside of the studio because I was preparing to teach, and I could hear his voice training you, you know, giving you the rhythms, and he sounded like a very young man. I couldn't believe it was Merce because his body was so frail, and yet you heard this booming voice when he was calling out the rhythms for this piece, and it was just astonishing.
What's it like from the dancer's perspective in those moments?
That moment when Merce would call one of us was rare, actually, in my time. We were given a lot of space to process the material, whether it was an existing repertory piece or even new material. And oftentimes, material would come from class for the new works, and you wouldn't even know who would be doing it until it was given to you. And then yet again, you were given a lot of space. So when your name was called, I mean, when he called your name and you went to him in his little corner, you were, I felt like every particle of your being was ready for that moment to absorb everything that he said. And sometimes it wasn't a lot. It might be three or four things. It could just be something about your arms that somehow translated for the entire movement or phrasing or whatever. So it would depend. But I think we were all waiting for these moments to have an interaction with Merce.
I'd love for the both of you to explain how Merce worked his internal rhythms, and then the music was on top of that. Because I find that, I actually, when in 1980, I did duets at American Ballet Theater, and Baryshnikov was in it, and all the principals were in it. And it was so fascinating to me to rehearse to these rhythms with no music. And then suddenly the music was put on top of that.
The thing about the way we learn the dances is Merce has this very, very strong rhythmic sense. And I say has. I've caught myself saying has because I can still feel it. I can still hear it. And that's what Andrea and I are trying to impart to the dancers, is the rhythm of the step, because it's not metric. Often not metric. Sometimes it is, but then it'll slide into a non-metric. So we rehearsed over and over and over with him singing, let's call it singing, and then without him, without his voice, and with a stopwatch. So everything, all the segments of a piece are timed very carefully. So we become so comfortable with the movement phrase that it exists in 15 seconds or 30 seconds, that even after maybe a long break, coming back to the piece, we can recreate it pretty much in the same time. Now, that said, when we would be first to hear the music, which would be in the performance, unlike what your experience was, Susan, I can't remember ever responding to anything, but I had to focus so strongly on what I was doing. And then I would hear this music and it would be, well, that's what the music is.
Just a little extra.
But it was not like I could take my mind off for a second what I was doing and respond to the music.
So the overriding driver for you was that internal rhythm, as had been rehearsed so carefully prior to that. How about you, Andrea?
I had both of your experiences. So first came exactly what Meg said. Everything was rehearsed, rhythmical timings, song. All of this as sort of an ensemble, even though we were all responsible for our own material. But for me, when the music was there, I would be fascinated by the chants, meetings. And I don't think that I was ever influenced in my performance because of the music, but I was very present to what was happening with the sound and the music.
They say you can develop perfect pitch, or, you know, develop your inner ear. Musicians can get better and better recognizing pitch. I'm wondering if that's something you can develop as a dancer as well, that ability to just be more attuned to this series of gestures is going to be 18 seconds. It's always going to be that. And then memorizing that. Is that a long process? Is that something you're just born with? Either have it or you don't?
Well, the body remembers. The body remembers. You rehearse so much that the body will just do it regardless, for me, whether or not I thought about it. So, for example, working in duets, the rhythms were so instilled in us that the body did it. It wasn't my mind at all. At one point, as a dancer, you have to sort of transcend your thoughts in a way and become part of the space and become a much larger rhythm and a much larger movement and a much larger than yourself. And so it's almost as if the air and your energy moves you instead of your mind.
Sound dance, in broad strokes. Tell me a little bit about this piece.
Sound dance is a little unusual in terms of Merce's aesthetic because there really does seem to be a beginning and ending to this piece. Looking at it now over all these many years, it could be almost described as dancers being or visualizing a black hole, because the piece begins with this one central figure spinning out of somewhere mysterious. And gradually, more and more people come on stage, like they're sucked into this very small space. And the dance seems to increase in energy as more and more people enter. And suddenly, these strange creatures begin to be formed, small at first, like a little, say, a sea coral or an anemone or something like that. And by the time the fourth and fifth women enter, that's now 10 people on stage, the energy level has built very, very high. And suddenly, out of that, a big, big creature begins to form. And there's, ironically, a moment of stillness and softness, but with this big, dangerous creature upstage left. Everybody is involved in making this creature. And then it begins to slowly break apart for no known reason. And at that moment, and there's 3 minutes left in the piece, this is a 17 and a half minute piece, 3 minutes left, and people get sucked out of back into the hole. And now, I'm describing this having worked on it for many, many years. Dancing in it, I never had any of this imagery. You know, we were just doing what we had to do very fast. But looking at it now, you know, I'm trying to encourage people to come and see it and say, oh my gosh, you know, this is one way of looking at it. There are many, many other ways of looking at the piece, but this is one way, thinking about space and a black hole and particles, meteorites flying all over and hitting each other and crashing and expanding.
What's it been like working with the School of the Arts dance students?
They are an astonishing group of, we have 21 extraordinary men and women of different ethnic backgrounds. You could not walk into a room with people who are more focused. These kids come in early to rehearsal. They practice their steps. They teach their parts to whoever needs help. And then during rehearsal, they're so respectful. It's totally ideal. We're both very, very impressed, and we've been able to teach almost the whole piece in 6 days because of the way they've been focused.
6 days? That strikes me as remarkable. Andrew, your perceptions early on. I mean,
it's absolutely remarkable. I get the sense that the training of what it is to be a professional dancer, that training is happening at this school. And these dancers that are cast have taken on the responsibility. They're exceptional dancers. They're amazing workers. And it's just clear to me that they're being prepared by the school, and they are taking responsibility for what it will be to be a professional.
Susan, what percentage of these dancers have an eye toward becoming a professional dancer as a career? And is it ever difficult for you in this teacher-student relationship, just knowing how competitive a world that is and preparing them for that?
I think most of them want to be a professional. It's a much tougher world than it was when I was a student about to become a professional. I think there are many more students in the world that want to be a professional than when I was young. So it is very competitive. And I was just looking at a YouTube video of a ballerina and remembering how, particularly in ballet, if you don't have the perfect length neck and the perfect length arms and the perfect feet and the perfect everything, you're most likely not going to get a job. And it's tough. It's a really tough, tough world. It's more free in the contemporary because you can have the most extraordinary dancers, and they don't have to be perfect aesthetically. They can be just these wonderful movers and thinkers, and they're glorious. But again, you don't have to have that everything has to have the right measurements. So, of course, I always tell the students who don't have the perfect aesthetic in the ballet division, think of a company, and I want you to do some research, and think of companies that where you would fit in. And then you audition for those companies. So they do that. And also a lot of them go, you know, to college in other universities as well. We have high school and college in school. But I would say a good percentage of them do become professionals. And then some go off to be choreographers and working in the dance world in all kinds of ways.
UNC School of the Arts Dean of Dance Susan Jaffe and dancers Meg Harper and Andrea Weber. Winter Dance 2015 will feature Merce Cunningham's amazing sound dance, Sir Frederick Ashton's challenging birthday offering, and two world premieres, UNCSA's Trish Casey's Looking Back and Susan Jaffe's Metallurgy, with original music by Bruno Lucharn. The performances continue through March 1st, with evening shows at 7:30 and a Sunday matinee at 2 in the Stevens Center in downtown Winston-Salem. You'll find ticket information and more at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. We'll return shortly with more of the great art going on right here in your own backyard next when Triad Arts Weekend continues. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Industries for the Blind is holding its very first Blind Idol singing competition this weekend. They had hundreds of competitors, and now it's down to 5 outstanding finalists. You can hear for yourself just about 20 minutes from now. But first, we'll put pen to paper. Poetry as Prayer, Prayer as Poetry, The Struggle for Faith in the Poems of John Donne and Gerard Manley Hopkins. That's the title of a fascinating new lecture series that'll be given next month by award-winning author, poet Anthony Abbott at Centenary United Methodist Church in Winston-Salem. In addition to being one of today's leading writers, Tony Abbott holds the distinction of being Professor Emeritus of English at Davidson College. He's an incredible lecturer and educator who's enjoyed a 50-year relationship with the college. Over 4 Tuesdays in March, Tony will explore the extraordinary lives of these two poet priests, Hopkins and Dunn, and look at how each used poetry to express their deep spiritual needs to God. Why these two men?
John Donne and Gerard Manley Hopkins were maybe the two greatest lyric religious poets in the history of English literature, both of whom were profoundly religious, and their stories parallel each other. So you got John Donne, born 1572, and he grew up as a Roman Catholic, and he had to decide if he wanted to be preferred in the English government and society. He had to switch to Anglicanism because the Church of England had been established, and when Queen Elizabeth became queen in 1558, essentially after that you could no longer get a position at court if you were a Catholic. And Donne was very ambitious. I think he felt tremendous guilt at abandoning the Catholic faith, which was the faith of his mother. Eventually, he became the dean of St. Paul's Cathedral and became the best preacher in England. But between the time that he was a young courtier and he wrote a lot of very famous love poems, and the time that he became dean of St. Paul's Cathedral, he went through a period in the middle of feeling great guilt, feeling like, I have betrayed my faith, I have sinned gravely, and I may go to hell. And so he wrote what we call the Holy Sonnets, which are tremendous poems in which he prays to God not to condemn him to hell. He's essentially trying to save his life by writing his way through this religious crisis. And those are the poems I'm going to focus on, the Holy Sonnets of John Donne. Hopkins started out as an Anglican and then became a Catholic. Born in 1844, starting out as an Anglican, he goes to Oxford and he's profoundly influenced by John Henry Cardinal Newman. And he decides that Catholicism is the true faith. And so he converts to Catholicism. And what happens to him? His family essentially abandons him. They are so offended. They're so hurt by his conversion to Catholicism. And he has to essentially give up all his honors at Oxford because There's certain things you could not do if you were a Catholic. It's still the case in the 19th century. The Anglican faith is the official faith of England. So by becoming a Catholic, and Hopkins not only became a Catholic, he became a Jesuit, and he swore himself to absolute celibacy. And so he went through like 7 or 8 years of Jesuit training. And during that time, he virtually gave up writing poetry because he felt it interfered with his duties as a Jesuit priest. But finally, the power of poetry was so strong that the poems came out. And he wrote these beautiful, beautiful sonnets, one of which is called God's Grandeur, which I'll read. And eventually, he was sent to Ireland. And Hopkins was miserable in Ireland because he was a true Englishman and the Irish were fighting for their independence and Hopkins didn't know what to do. He went through a crisis in his faith and he wrote what was called the Terrible Sonnets, which are sonnets in which he's really wrestling with God to try to give him the grace to live his life.
Looking through the period in which Don grew up and the torturesome lineage, and from his mother's side of the family, the martyrs that were killed.
That's right.
Just by association,
including Sir Thomas More. Yeah, it was in Dunn's side of the family.
A big one.
Yeah.
These struggles between Catholicism and Anglicanism, right. Protestantism, it perils so much Sunni Shia in terms of the extent of the violence against it.
And it was a violent, violent thing. I mean, people's religious manners were horrible, horrible. And you have the whole 30 years' war going on between Protestants and Catholics all over Europe. So, and it's very interesting that the English prejudice against Catholics really lasted all the way up through into the 20th century.
Hopkins and beyond.
Hopkins and beyond.
This was, and I'm sure you're familiar with this story, but Don's brother, Henry, was also a university student prior to his arrest in the late 1500s for harboring a Catholic priest.
Yeah. That's right.
Tell that tale. Talk about a grisly end.
He died in prison.
He died in prison, but the man he helped actually was tortured on the rack,
was hanged
until
and,
not
and
quite
drawn
dead,
and quartered.
And disemboweled.
And Dunn saw that probably. And there were a number of those executions that they hanged him, and then they cut them down while they were still alive and eviscerated them. Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that Dunn felt so guilty about. You know, he also probably felt very guilty about his sex life. I mean, there are really three John Donnes. There's what he calls Jack Donne, who is the early Donne, who was quite a libertine and a ladies' man, very handsome. He was a soldier. You know, he went off with the Earl of Essex on this expedition to Cadiz, and he was very handsome, very attractive. He loved women. He had a lot of affairs. And then he fell in love with Anne Moore, who was his patron's niece, and he married her clandestinely, and the family was aghast, and so he lost everything. He and Anne Moore had an incredible marriage, beautiful, beautiful, beautiful marriage. And while he was married to Anne Moore, I think he began feeling very, very badly about his early sex life, which had been pretty wild, in addition to his Catholicism. Then when he became Dean of St. Paul's, after his wife died, he continued to feel guilty about his past life and wrote a lot of poems to God asking for forgiveness. Donne's most famous poem is Holy Sonnet number 6, which is called Death Be Not Proud. Death be not proud, though some have called thee mighty and dreadful, for thou art not so. For those whom thou think'st thou dost o'erthrow, die not, poor death, nor canst thou yet kill me. From rest and sleep, which but thy pictures be, much pleasure, then from thee much more must flow, and soonest our best men with thee do go, rest of their bones and souls' delivery. Thou art slave to fate, chance, kings, and desperate men, and dost with poison, war, and sickness dwell, and poppy or charms can make us sleep as well and better than thy stroke. Why swellest thou then? One short sleep past, we wake eternally, and death shall be no more. Death, thou shalt die.
death thou shalt die.
Yeah, isn't that great?
Wow.
Probably based on St. Paul's Epistle to the Romans, O death, where is thy sting? O death, where is thy victory? It's probably a meditation that comes out of that, because it's through Christ we defeat death. Death, thou shalt die.
He's been described, Tony, as the greatest metaphysical poet. And I'm wondering, is there a metaphysical element within the poem you just read that you could reference?
Well, you know, T.S. Eliot was very influential in making the metaphysical poets popular in the 20th century. And I think by metaphysical, it means that they deal with intellectual subjects as opposed to just writing poems about love or the common subjects for sonnets, but they deal with religion and philosophy, and they have a lot of intellectual substance and a lot of playing on words. So part of the metaphysical nature of the poem is like paradox and wit and irony. So when he says, you know, one short sleep past, we wake eternally, and death shall be no more. Death, thou shalt die. Because if we wake eternally, then death no longer exists. But the irony is that if he really believed that, he wouldn't have written the poem, because the poem is a what we would call a protest against death. He's trying so hard to convince himself that it's true. You know, death be not proud. Well, the thing is that he's terribly worried about death. The very famous thing about Donne, he had his sculpture made in his shroud. You remember that? And if you go to St. Paul's and you go downstairs in the basement underneath St. Paul's Cathedral, that statue there of Donne's memorial of Donne in his shroud is just an astonishing piece of work.
It almost looks like he's grinning in it, though. Like he's gotten the last laugh somehow. It's a strange...
Because he spent his whole life preparing for death. I mean, that's so many of his sermons deal with death.
We could talk about Donne all day. We need to move on with Hopkins and... maybe a selection that you'll be sharing with the folks at Centenary that kind of speaks to his inner turmoil that he was going through in his life.
I want to read my favorite Hopkins poem, and I'm going to recite it because I recite it so often. I love this poem. It's called God's Grandeur. And it seems to me profoundly about what Hopkins really cared about. So let me recite it, and then I can talk about it a little bit. God's Grandeur. The world is charged with the grandeur of God. It will flame out like shining from shook foil. It gathers to a greatness like the ooze of oil crushed. Why do men then now not wreck his rod? Generations have trod, and all is seared with trade, bleared, smeared with toil, and shares man's smudge and wears man's smell. The soil is bare now, nor can foot feel being shod. And for all this, nature is never spent. There lives the dearest freshness deep down things. And though the last lights off the black west went, morning at the brown brink eastward springs, because the Holy Ghost over the bent world broods with warm breast and with, bright wings.
Boy, the way he brings in nature in his poetry, it's stunning, the connection.
Yeah, because Hopkins was at school in Wales as part of his training to become a Jesuit. They had 7 years of training, and he loved this. He loved Wales. He loved the Welsh language. He loved the musicality of the Welsh, and he loved the Welsh countryside. His most famous poem written in Wales is called The Windhover, which is about a bird he saw, a hawk, called a windhover. He went out in the Welsh countryside, and he says to himself, you know, here is Liverpool, here is Manchester, here are all these cities, and they're black with filth. I mean, this is 1870 or something.
We're right in the
Industrial Revolution, and these cities, you can't even breathe in these cities. You know, why do men then now not wreck his rod? You know, I tell myself to reck means to reckon. It means to pay attention to. Why don't you pay attention to God's law? Generations have trod, and all is seared with trade, bleared, smeared with toil, and wears man's smudge and shares man's smell. This is what we've done to the earth. I mean, I think in 2015, this poem is absolutely contemporary, because we're still doing it. And he says, the world is charged with the grandeur of God. It will flame out like shining from shook foil. Why don't you pay attention to it? Just because you don't see it doesn't mean it isn't there. So why do you go on with this stupid, filthy, dirty life? And then he says, you know, generations have trod. The soil is bare now, nor can foot feel being shod, because if you're wearing shoes, you can't feel the soil. Why is the soil bare? Nothing will grow there. But for all this, nature is never spent. There lives the dearest freshness deep down things. Nature's God's creation, and that God will sustain nature. And the Holy Ghost, listen, broods over the bent world as if it's kind of holding the world in its wings and nurturing it. And what he's saying is, pay attention to this. This is the ultimate reality, not this terrible dirt that you're creating here, this blackness, this coal. And I think that Hopkins spent his whole life trying to, he believed so profoundly in his faith. Hopkins' faith was much stronger than Dunn's, because Dunn always worried about whether he was going to go to hell because he had lived such a bad life. I don't think Hopkins ever worried about that. I think what Hopkins worried about was, if God loves me, why am I so unhappy? I mean, that's because his life was so unproductive, and he was so sad that he could never, so much of the joy of life had been taken away from him. He loved Wales. He was happier in Wales than any place else. But at the end, the last few years, he was in Dublin, and the sickness was rife. Dublin in 1888, 1889 was just a mass of disease. He never got the chance to fulfill his life, in the way that he had dreamed that he hoped it would be.
To our benefit, it seems like because he was dreaming, the vividness of those dreams and his vision of what heaven could be is so powerful in the poetry.
Right, and these terrible sonnets at the end are so sad, because he's saying, there's one very famous one called, "Thou art indeed just, Lord. But so I plead with you, why do all these sinners prosper when I, who love you so much, am so miserable?" You know, he begs God for grace. He says, mine, send my roots rain. I love that line. Send my roots rain. I'm drying up here. I need your grace. I need the rain. I need you to cultivate my heart. Dunn says, batter my heart, three-person God. You know, they both are inviting God to remake them, to give them life. And so they do. I think they definitely go together. I think Hopkins was a beautiful man, and everybody loved him. He was a person that no one really ever said anything bad about. Well, one can't say the same about John Donne. John Donne was very controversial.
Great. Well, Tony, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Well, I enjoyed it very much. It's always a pleasure to be with you. And when I come back to Centenary, we'll meet again.
See you next year. Award-winning poet and novelist Anthony Abbott is the author of 5 books of poetry, including the Pulitzer-nominated The Girl in the Yellow Raincoat. Tony's lecture series at Centenary United Methodist Church is Poetry as Prayer, Prayer as Poetry, The Struggle for Faith in the Poems of John Donne and Gerard Manley Hopkins. It'll be 4 of the 5 Tuesday evenings next month at Centenary. They're free and open to the public, and you'll find links at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and we'll take another short break now before returning with some of our state's most talented singers who just happen to be visually impaired. It's Blind Idol, just about 60 seconds away. And film scholar Dale Pollack will give us his take on why sci-fi movies have become so consistently bleak for so many years. Behind the scenes, next, when Triad Arts Weekend continues.
This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. North Carolina's best singers, who also happen to be legally blind, are participating in the first ever Blind Idol singing competition this weekend. The competition began in the fall with audio submissions that led to the selection of 20 semifinalists who auditioned on December 6th at the Shirley Recital Hall at Salem College. We're sampling from one of those performances right now. The event is organized by Winston-Salem Industries for the Blind. The judges selected five finalists to perform in the final competition, and it'll be held on Saturday, February 28th at the Southeastern Center for Contemporary Art, SECA, in Winston-Salem. Each contestant will be accompanied by a live band and perform one piece as a group and two individual pieces, with the winner receiving a grand prize package valued at $3,000. There'll be a $1,000 cash award, recording time in a professional studio, professional headshot, and wardrobe gift card. Chris Flint is the director of IFB's A Brighter Path community outreach programs. He's joined by program associate and Blind Idol co-organizer Anastasia Powell. Chris, A Brighter Path, helping others who are blind or visually impaired is a real big part of what you do with Industries of the Blind. How did the program you helped develop achieve some of those goals, talking about A Brighter Path?
Well, we started with a multi-purpose room with a couple of computers and some books on tape. And this was our first foray into providing some type of service other than employment at IFB. So it was something that was needed, and it immediately just took off.
Yeah. What sorts of reactions do you get from folks who participate in the program in terms of the impact it's had on their lives?
Well, it's great impact. In fact, I think one of the best folks we got here to talk about that is Anastasia. She started getting involved with other things than working in the plant through the programming. I think your first one was Toastmasters.
Toastmasters, yes.
Well, tell me about that. I mean, this is, so you were taking part in the program before working at IFB? Break that down for me.
Actually, I started out a sewing machine operator, and I remember sitting at my sewing machine and hearing the announcements of all the extracurricular activities that IFB's A Brighter Path offered. And so I just decided to take part. And before, about 10 years ago, I'd never sat in front of a keyboard. And now that's something I use every day for my job. And so the program really changes and touches lives. A lot of people that participate in the programs, they start out with no skills and end up with skills that they can use outside of IFB.
Sensitivity to blindness training, that program is something that's interested me. Chris?
Yes, that's a mandatory program we require for all sighted employees to go through. And it's about a six-hour program, and it's not to create any sympathy for blind or visually impaired, but to show awareness on how we do survive and what we do day to day.
I guess that would lead into misperceptions, what folks think going into dealing with people who are either visually impaired or blind. What are some of those misconceptions that are out there that you run across?
Well, the greatest thing is people just aren't aware of what it's like to be blind. You know, they don't have that experience. So my opinion basically is that people look at us not that we're menacing or anything in a bad way, but they just don't want to be like us. They don't want to be blind. And Anastasia can also speak to this, but being in a store, we can hear parents grabbing their kids. Come here. You know, just a misconception of we're people who don't see, and that's the only difference.
How does it, from your perspective, Anastasia, I mean, those misconceptions and how you'd like for the message to get out there in dealing with those?
I guess if we could almost sum it up in one word, incapable. That's how people perceive us. And just for them to step back and understand that, as Chris said, we just have no sight, but we're capable of doing anything that anyone else can.
When I first visited Industries for the Blind, just down the road here, it's really a two-minute drive up University, I was blown away by the size, the scope of this place, and the numbers of folks working, doing things anywhere from mattress design and or lens crafting. Could you give us an overview, Chris, of what all goes on there?
Yes, we're very diverse, and since you visited last, we probably tripled in size. We are wow. Number one employer, blind and visually impaired, in America. We have a lot more sewing projects than when you were there. A couple other projects we brought in are parachutes. We make scissors, as you mentioned, making the glasses for the veterans. A lot of stuff people wouldn't think blind people were capable of doing, we do it right there. And it's very diverse, so we can handle all skill levels of people who are blind and visually impaired.
How many employees?
We got right at 700 now, not just here in Winston, but we also have a facility in Asheville. And we just now purchased Lighthouse in Arkansas, Arkansas Lighthouse for the Blind.
Hey, Anastasia, what are you most proud of in terms of the company itself, in terms of the Industries for the Blind?
Most proud of the opportunity that they allow us, you know, they allow us to reach, you know, for the stars, and the programs that they have that equipped us with the tools and skills we need to succeed in all areas of life.
Well, I'm wanting to know from you, since this is the we're dealing with the brainchild of Blind Idol here.
Yes.
Moving into this, how did the idea come to you?
Well, we know that all the singing shows are the craze now, American Idol, you know, The Voice, and we just want to jump on that bandwagon and leave our footprint behind and let, you know, help others understand, hey, pursue your dreams, follow your, you know, talents, just go for it. And we wanted them to know, hey, let's do it.
Too bad it is the life you lead. You get ahead of yourself and you forget what you need. You can see when you're wrong, but you can't often see when you're right. And you're right.
So far we've had the initial rounds. You've whittled it down to five finalists. But before getting there, let's put it in perspective. I mean, you had quite a turnout for this.
We did. It was just an amazing journey so far. As you said, we've had the initial rounds. We started in September. The close of that was September 30th, and we had a good participation for that. And then the semifinals was at Salem College on December the 6th, and we had a turnout of over 240 people there to support our Blind Idol contestants. And as you said, we did it down to five, and now everybody is so excited. That's going to be held at SECA, the Southeastern Center for Contemporary Art, on February the 28th. And the doors will open at 6:30. The show will start at 7, and it's going to be electrifying.
Having had the privilege of listening to some of the early tapes from those initial rounds, I was blown away by the quality of the singing. Chris, along the way here, this process, the competition, what surprised you about it so far?
Well, like you said, the level of talent. Plus, we had folks from Raleigh, Charlotte, Asheville, from around the state competing, which is really, really good to see.
When we get there and get a chance to take it all in, what can we expect to see? I love that venue, by the way. I think it's a perfect size, like 300-seater.
It is.
Intimate, and yet plenty of space to take it in. Put me in the seat there. What can we expect?
There's going to be a cash bar.
Cash bar.
Cash bar's in the hallway.
Well, it's going to be tough competition. As you all has already said, a lot of talent, and I just would not want to be a judge.
My darling.
Who sang that Whitney Houston classic?
Taffany Bolger, Winston-Salem.
Taffany bowled me over, I got to say. Well, let's find out a little bit about some of our finalists. Anastasia, I'll throw it your way first.
Okay, well, Taffany Bolger, she's from Winston-Salem. She used to work at Industries for the Blind in our sewing department, and she's a fantastic person. She loves music. She used to sing in our IFB community choir. And then Shane Dittmer, he is an amazing musician. I'd love to listen to some of his pieces. He's an Elon student. He's from Raleigh. And he has just wowed us every time we've heard him perform. And then we have Lucille Mahoney. She works at our Asheville facility for Winston-Salem Industries for the Blind. And she is just the sweetest, most humble contestant I think we have. And then we have Jennifer Finley. She currently works at Industries for the Blind. And she is just super excited for the opportunity and to be a part of this. Oh, and Charity, our youngest.
She came through our after-school program, summer camp.
Yes.
As well.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. She's Broadway, very, very talented.
So 2 weeks to go. If we're getting down to the wire, I guess when this airs, it'll be just about a week to go. What's the feeling in the room? How are you all feeling about things?
Oh, we're feeling good.
Yeah, very good. I just hope everyone around me knows CPR in case I...
We'll have paramedics. Security will be there.
Yes, but I think it's going to be amazing.
Industries for the Blinds, a Brighter Path Community Outreach Program's Program Associate and Blind Idol Co-Organizer Anastasia Powell, and she was joined by Director Chris Flint. The final Blind Idol competition is Saturday night, February 28th, at the Southeastern Center for Contemporary Art, SECA, in Winston-Salem. Competition begins at 7, the doors open at 6:30, and each contestant will be accompanied by a live band. They'll perform one piece as a group and two individual pieces, with the winner receiving a grand prize package valued at $3,000. You'll find more information on our website, WFDD.org, and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. And after that uplifting segment, it's time to, well, get a little dark. And maybe, just maybe, a little hopeful at least, with film producer, writer, and UNC School of the Arts professor Dale Pollack. He takes us behind the scenes and light years into the future.
A dying earth. Poverty. Oppression. Suppression. Violence. Disease, scarcity. Does all this sound familiar? Have you been to the movies lately? Why does the future always look so bad in current films? Think about Interstellar, Elysium, or Edge of Tomorrow. Sci-fi used to be a positive thing, starting with Jules Verne and his fabulous adventure to the moon, one that was recapitulated by Georges Méliès in one of the earliest films at the beginning of the 20th century, and in the famous 1936 movie Things to Come, the designer William Cameron Menzies, who by the way also designed Gone with the Wind, directed a glamorous future of space travel and universal happiness. Even into the 1950s, sci-fi was fun. You got to go to distant planets. But somehow, utopia became dystopia. And although there was always a darker future in science fiction, think about George Orwell's 1984, which, by the way, has been made into a film three different times, movies began to reflect the post-apocalyptic strain that's always been in American culture. So Planet of the Apes, A Clockwork Orange, even Fritz Lang's silent film, Metropolis, all paint a future that's not too rosy and not too bright. The new dystopia is, of course, occasioned by climate change and relevant concerns. And it seems to be really about the destruction of our planet. In Interstellar, we have to leave it, it's so bad. Left Behind, another kind of dystopian movie, is about the real apocalypse, at least in the Bible's version of it. In Edge of Tomorrow, we face a future of endless war. Even Noah presents a dystopian future because in that movie, God has had enough of us. There are industrial dystopian films like Brazil, biblical dystopian films like Denzel Washington striding through the Book of Eli. There's even extraterrestrial dystopia in the movie District 9, when the aliens lived in a slum in South Africa. The success of The Hunger Games and Divergent, two young adult novels that have spawned wildly successful movies, is really based on the premise that the present is going to devolve, not evolve, and we're moving backwards, not forwards, in society. Is our future really the purge, a 12-hour period once a year when all criminal activity is legal? That's what you might think if you go to the movies often. I guess all this indicates we don't really feel too optimistic about our future. But maybe that can change if we change the kind of movies we make. Because it goes back to the old question, do movies mirror our actions or do they induce them? Are films making us more depressed about the future? And if so, maybe what we need to be watching is a brighter and shinier tomorrow.
Behind the Scenes with film producer, writer, and UNC School of the Arts professor Dale Pollack. You'll find a link to Dale's Movie A Day blog on our website, wfdd.org, and click on Triad Arts Weekend. Well, that's all for today's show. Our technical producer is Eddie Garcia, our associate producer is Bethany Chafin, and our intern is Elena Dolman. You'll find podcasts, archive programs, and links to all our guests on our website, wfdd.org, and click on Triad Arts Weekend. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions, we'd love to hear from you. Drop us an email at triadarts@wfu.edu. You can follow us on Twitter for quick picks and other local arts events to put on your to-do list. It's Triad Arts Speak with one S. I'm David Ford. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.